everybody, and welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Lindsay Hughley.
And I'm Elizabeth Ultra.
And we've got a super special episode today. We are actually all together for our annual company meeting, and we have brought some people from across Compliance Alliance in today to go give their insight on some regulatory hot topics.
We are very excited to introduce Jeff Swilly, who heads up our newest branch of services with Tailored Solutions. We have Brett Goodnack from the Compliance Hub team, and we have Kelly Owsley from Virtual Partners.
Yes, and so today everyone's going to get to dive into kind of what their niche specialty is, and we're going to start with you, Kelly. We are kind of interested in what is your insight with the new executive order that President Trump has put out, really trying to get rid of the disparate impact?
So the executive order came out back in April of this year, and it was titled Restoring Equality of Opportunity and Meritocracy. And so what this was all about was to eliminate the use of disparate impact liability within all government organizations. So that includes financial institutions, that includes HUD, for example. And so that is a reminder, because that concept of disparate impact is sometimes it's gray. And so it's very difficult to understand kind of what that involves. So if you think about it from the perspective of the bank's policies and their practices and what they do, but basically it's where members of a group are treated less favorably when that bank applies what we think of as a neutral policy for the practice, and they apply fully to all credit applicants. But that policy or that practice creates an exclusion or a burden on certain groups based on prohibited bases. And so it kind of dives into some of those elements of Reg B and fair housing. And so an example of disparate treatment and or disparate impact is when a bank establishes like a minimum loan amount in their policy, you get $100,000. So from a bank's perspective, their view, but we don't really want to do mortgages under $100,000 because of the cost associated with that. But with creating that threshold, it may be carving out a portion or a segment of the population that's lower income, which could include like minority groups and things of that nature. And so disparate impact has always been examined in that way. But again, it's kind of a gray area, and it's been left up to a lot of interpretation. We're in the regulatory standards and many financial institutions. So that's kind of the basis behind this executive order coming out is to try to eliminate that.
And so with the elimination, do you have any thoughts on the purpose behind it? Like, what is the goal that they're trying to achieve by eliminating disparate impact?
So kind of the rationale behind it was to, it forces race-conscious practices, compelling the regulatory agencies and kind of other governmental organizations to consider demographics specifically over peers. And so, which is what the current administration needs to be unconstitutional. So that's kind of the basis and why this shift has come about, this executive order.
And so I know that this starts as an executive order. So what have we seen so far with the regulatory agencies? How are they moving and handling this?
So the regulatory agencies have all, of course, accepted it and have started to take action. We saw the very first regulatory agency that took action was the OCC. I believe they were the first. The CFPB came out and said, yes, we will, accept it. We'll move on it. That I believe the OCC was really the first one to bank changes as far as their exam manuals. And so those changes came about in July. So it wasn't too far after the April executive order came out. We then saw just recently the FDIC made changes to their being austerity exam manuals. So kind of August, at least 1/8 is what we saw. And so we're starting to gradually see disparate impact just completely worked out. They have struck through that in their exam manuals. And so we're also hearing from our bankers that in the exams that they have had since the executive order came out, that they're not hearing about disparate impact at all in the exams, but it is not being brought up as a topic. So that's kind of where we are with the bankers' perspective.
So is just the elimination of disparate impact from exams. Is that the only thing that we've kind of seen about how our members, member banks are handling this, or what else have you seen?
Well, we have seen banks go from, yes, we have adjusted our policies and our procedures to ensure, you know, that disparate impact is no longer a part of those. But we also have had members that have said, look, this is just an executive order at this point. It hasn't been built into regulation. And so until we see it move into a form of regulation, we're not going to strike it out of our policy. We're going to continue to do business as usual, basically. And that's the thing you have to keep in mind is this was one element of fair lending. And so fair lending is still on the table. It is still a huge aspect of our examinations. It's something we still need to take into consideration. You still have overt disparate treatment and still have the imperative disparate treatment. So we're going to continue.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly. I think this segues really well into what we wanted to ask Jeff about, because Jeff has had the pleasure of diving into one of the impacts of some of these executive orders. And I was hoping, Jeff, you could talk about the SBA orders specifically and how banks are handling some of that. So if you could speak a little bit about what are these SBA orders, what happened, kind of building on what Kelly just talked about, what brought us here.
Absolutely. And I agree. I think the intent behind the executive order I'm going to speak to, it's very similar to the issue around disparate impact in that the current administration is trying to remove some subjectivity in some bank decisions. And in general, this executive order tries to remove what they call the reputational risk factor bank. It ask banks through an executive order, in this case, through the directive of the SBA, to review their decisions. And it doesn't really give you a time lift on those
decisions,
unfortunately, but to look back at your decisions and determine if any of those decisions may have been based on what the customer did or features of a customer or the type of business the customer was in, rather than their financial condition or their creditworthiness. And that's where they want to get away from. They don't want that kind of thing in sense of, you don't like this type of customer because they're dealing in firearms or some types of, the illegal activities that are illegal in certain states, that sort of thing. So, it's a little bit of a push to get back to suit with only financial credit for the state bank.
So I wanted to ask you in general how banks are handling this, but also the nuance of how this intersects between a bank's policy. Banks are permitted to have their own lending policy. They're permitted to have their own standards. But of course, this is now asking banks to use objective criteria for these SBA loans. So what are you seeing, and this is all pretty new, but what are you seeing banks doing to kind of balance some of those different considerations between their lending procedures and policies?
We've seen bank laws, look at their policies and procedures. Some have expressed concern to me, some have voiced the opinion, especially some small tail banks where I've had one bank express concern. They said, we might not be able to kind of liquor stores in some of our community because some of the community members don't like that. They would look negatively on that. So the banks that had to go back and look at all their credit qualifications of what they look at with each decision and make sure that it looks strictly at the financial condition and not the perceived ripping take a risk that may be out there.
That makes a lot of sense. Do you see banks doing anything moving forward with changes procedurally, or is it more of a look back project that might be kind of a one-time thing? Or are there significant changes to lending policy procedures that might be in the works with some of the banks that you've been talking to?
Honestly, I think most banks don't see any major changes in their lending policy or procedures. I think most banks have not really considered reputational risk to a great deal. And the banks that we've dealt with have done at least a partial look back. I mean, the orders have done something new. So they have had time to do at least a partial look back, and they're not seeing any indication of GMO food is denied due to just something, you know, just related to this state we're in. It's been an actual financial condition. So I don't anticipate there being a great deal of change as far as all the procedures. The main concern that banks have right now is how to respond to the SBA's letter that over 5,000 ticket lenders received, telling them they had to go back and look at their past decisions and determine if there was any kind of reputation risk or not a consideration, the political or religious trade kind of these customers. And that's their main concern in how to respond. Now, the SBA did have a strong recent thing about that I think allayed some of the fears that a lot of banks had. The banks felt like they were going to have to provide extremely detailed response. And that doesn't seem to be the case. It's not going to be to that extent. I mean, all banks have to respond, but I think the fears of it taking, you know, weeks and weeks of manpower time to respond to all of this is a little bit overboard. I don't think it's going to be that intense.
I'm glad to hear from you directly how banks are responding to this and kind of alleviating some of the concerns from some banks that have been through a little bit of their look back process and it hasn't been as burdensome as maybe there were concerns on. Thank you, Jeff, for sharing that. Really, really appreciate that.
Awesome. Okay, Brett. So we're going to totally shift gears, kind of come into a different area of things. So I wanted to ask, what are your thoughts and what are you seeing on some of the recent fencing guidances related to fentanyl from the FENDOF Fentanyl Act?
Yeah, absolutely. So those are the 2313A orders that everybody has been talking about. And they target three financial institutions. And FinCEN's put out a lot of guidance. They've extended the orders twice now with the extended date being the end of October, Matt, or middle of October, I think. So banks have quite a while to meet the action items of the orders. And basically what the action items are that they have to stop transmittals with these three specific financial institutions, but also have to elevate them as high risk in their customer identification programs, their BSA or AML programs, all kind. What we get a lot on the hotline is, why is this all of a sudden a big concern? Because 2313A is an order pursuant to 311. 311 is the Treasury's power to do special measure orders. They've done a lot of special measure orders. They've done a lot over the years. There are a lot that are in effect that hypothetically banks should have on their BSA programs.
Strength
with other institutions that they should have lots of transmittals with that we're getting questions on that are like, well we didn't know about these stuff. Russian entities like Big Plateau. I should have said more gusto. Looked at, and why is this all of a sudden like something that they're championing and broadcasting so much? Frankly, I don't know, because they're all very narrow in their scope. They all target just specific entities. I think it's because the Fentanyl Act, which you referenced, has become a really big platform for the current administration. They're really using this as the past administration too was big against. Nobody likes men. Let's get that message out there now. But it's become a really big piece for the Treasury, and I don't know why all of a sudden it's something that they're focusing on more so than in the past. But that doesn't change history. You still have to have blocks these other institutions
and
as
so
well.
And so at the end of the day, with the guidances that are focused on those three institutions for targeting fentanyl, mm-hmm. is the majority of the way that banks need to move forward with this is focusing on making sure that they're not transacting with these banks?
Right. Yeah. The guidance is actually pretty helpful. Vincent does a lot of things. They do a lot of things, but they do something exceptionally well, and I think they address a lot of their orders with FAQs in a pretty helpful manner. And the ones that they put out with the orders, I think, address them with enough wiggle room where banks can interpret it the way that they best see fit. But the FAQs specifically say don't have to look back and go and plot things in the past. It's forward looking and have to cease transmittals going forward. You don't have to be a light. Lack of clarity with other things.
Right.
They made that whole point to them.
And we always appreciate that when something regulatory-wise is very black and white.
Yeah.
And then, so also, there's been another fencing guidance that came out in June this summer regarding alternate collection of CIP information.
Yes.
And I know that just from what I've experienced with my banks, they have wondered, how does this incorporate with us? Most of the people that I talk to are community banks. So can you shed some light on what exactly is that guidance referring to?
Sure. A lot of people are, about a few, I haven't talked to anybody, but I say a lot of people, they say, I don't know if anybody's saying anything, but I'm calling it the TIN carve-out because it allows banks, community banks specifically, under the jurisdictions of the regulatory agencies who issue the interagency order to rely on third parties under your customer identification program, you are required to get basic identifying information from your customers at home. One of those pieces of information is their social security number or their tax identification number. And usually you have to get that straight from the customer themselves. But this little carve out lets you get that from a third party. Third parties now, they weren't very specific here, but if you read between the lines, those are going to be like the same kinds of the entities like Bigfoot, the same kind of entities that banks rely on to screen for KYC. And so they can use those same companies to not only see if they're a politically exposed person, but they can pull their, and they can also use credit bureaus and that kind of thing too. And so it saves a lot of time when they can get certain information without having to. They have their pre-made card that they get to the customer and say, sign this, here's your account, ready to go. And there they go. Now, I don't know in practice what else that looks like because I'm out of these community banks, but the people I've talked to, and again, haven't talked to anybody, they seem to like that. Banks like.
So I do think that this is going to open up an opportunity for community banks to take on and work with a third party to maybe allow for an easier access for online bank, like opening online accounts and those types of situations. And so I know that this started out as fencing guidance. Have we seen any of the regulatory agencies pick up on this and start incorporating and supporting this? Because that is one area that is always examined and looked at as well.
FDIC has picked up on it. As far as I know, they are the open birds. Maybe the OCC also got them too? Yeah, right. And as with any of those kind of things, I mean, eventually the cool kids get on it too and takes out the pieces. So I think it's only a matter of time till everybody does it. As like with the other the exceptions, we see every agency eventually partake. So I mean, I would get the gloomy surprise of how jumping on a bandwagon too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Brett. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Kelly. So excited that we were able to do this together. And for the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters.